Hey listeners, this is a podcast written by a software engineer. I'm Perry Tsu, software engineer and engine manager, and on this episode I get to talk to Jennifer Perota, Chief Technology Officer at WeWork. She shares so many great stories on what makes her who she is today, and I can't wait for you guys to hear them. As usual, make sure to follow the podcast on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. All the links are shared at perrytsu.com/podcast. If you'd like to check out podcasts written by a software engineer merch, they are available at perrytsu.com/shop. On to the show. Enjoy. Welcome back to another episode of a podcast written by a software engineer. I'm your host, Perry. Today, we have the absolute pleasure to have Jennifer Perota on the show. Jennifer is CTO of WeWork. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
No, it's a pleasure, not just for me. I feel like I speak for everybody on this show, which I really shouldn't at the end of the day. But no, it's something that I'm really excited about because, of course, having gotten the chance to work with you and just see how you think about problems and look at problems and how it affects so many people around you, that's something that why I keep on saying that I'm so lucky to be able to like poke at your brain a little bit about that. Sorry. But even before we dive into all the fun topics, as a general, like, who is Jen? Like a 30-second blurb, like, how would you describe Jen at the end of the day?
Wow. Okay, so 30-second blurb. So let's see. I love being on the water. So I am a jet skier at heart. And I grew up in Jersey. My email address is Jersey.
No way.
So I love my home state of New Jersey. And yeah, I've had such a wonderful, so many wonderful experiences all over the world. So who is Jen traveling, hanging out on a jet ski and just, you know, being me?
No, that's great. Jersey Jen, Jersey Mike, Jersey all the other ones out there. Oh, that is so, so, so fun. But I'm already glad you brought up in terms of like hometown and influences, because that's something that I absolutely love hearing from guests all over the place in terms of you do stuff day to day because you have so much behind you, so much history behind you and everything. So I think to really just kick it off in terms of like your hometown, New Jersey, my question would be, how techy was it? Obviously, it's a tech show at the end of the day. Like, what do you remember from that?
So the mayor of our town, very small town, Carlstadt, New Jersey, in Bergen County, owned a software company. And my father worked at AT&T, and he was in QA. He was a tester. That's pretty much as techy as you got in my town. We weren't one of those schools that had, you know, the devices when you were in grammar school or high school at all. But we had some folks, you know, in the town that were techie.
No, that's great though, because even thinking about like the composition of the town, most of the time, like even the neighborhood I grew up is like, oh, that person works in plumbing, that person works in that, and then once you discover those kind of niches. But also when we're talking about just growing up in a neighborhood that, yeah, you already had some good influence in terms of like somebody working at AT&T and then all of that. So in your childhood, in terms of like these individuals that are close to you worked in tech, what was that relationship look like, influence? Like, how much did you learn from it very early in your life? And yeah, just reminiscing about that.
Yeah, I always remember in my basement, my dad was always tinkering, right? I remember in my mind, I see circuit boards, right, all over the basement, right? And then the mayor of our town, you know, just going back to him as well, he had a private jet that he used to go to his company every day, and he flew out of Teterboro Airport. And I remember thinking to myself, wow, that's one heck of a commute, right? So we had my dad in the basement, you know, playing at nights and on the weekends, and him taking a commute, you know, up and down the Jersey Turnpike, and, you know, our mayor flying in his private jet. So I think the commute to work to these jobs was something that was always in my mind. So it's like an interesting, you know, it's an interesting correlation.
Yeah, I'm already jealous in terms of like that exposure. Not that I haven't seen any planes when I was a kid, but in terms of being that much closer on it. And even when you mentioned in terms of like circuit boards, what did you understand out of it to begin with? Or did you just know that your dad plays with it?
Initially, I didn't. You know, he was down there, and he was doing his thing. He had his books out, and you know, I was very fortunate in the house because he has a very teaching mindset. Mm-hmm. So everything that he was doing, you know, he would walk me through, of course, if I was interested, right, depending on the age that I was. And, you know, his patience really helped me, I think, become the type of manager and leader I want to be, you know, and am today, because, you know, I really learned a lot about taking the time to teach the things that you're interested in to anybody that wants to learn.
Yeah, I mean, even the word screaming teaching, like, I see where it comes from. Like, in terms of, like, if that wasn't self-explanatory enough, just by going back to the fact that I've learned so much from you just day to day, so I definitely do want to, I keep on saying it's a goal for myself even, to reciprocate a lot of it, where it's like, at some point, the life is just too big to not be sharing that kind of stuff.
So. I think that's one of the best life lessons, if I could get a little bit philosophical for a moment, right? Because it's so important for everyone that learns something to just pass it on. And I don't think we do enough of that anymore, but I'm starting to see it more and more, and it makes me so happy to hear you say that.
Oh, man. but if I get the chance to geek out even more, one thing that I love hearing is when we talk about these circuit boards and everything, those are kind of like tangible stuff that people play with during their childhood. For example, for us, I mean, on the software side, growing up, we played like Roller Coaster with Tycoon, and then we had like Tamagotchis, which are like small little gadgets on that. But I guess from your past, in terms of, was there any memorable like technology or gadgets that were present you're playing with, or you just had hands on?
I'm gonna probably date myself, but I remember the day that we got Commodore 64.
Yeah.
And then I guess more importantly, which was probably, the early 90s by the time we got one. But I remember getting one of the first compacts, and then playing Oregon Trail with my friends.
Oh my God.
And remember, back at that time, you actually were able to enter the code to have the wagon go to the next place that you wanted it to go, right? And it was such a fun experience.
It almost feels like a full circle sometimes, because you're saying like so low level, so into the code, yeah. And doing all that. There are games out there nowadays that are kind of coming back to that sense where it's like, oh, just plug these code in, these commands in, and then your character is going to do X, Y, Z. Mm-hmm. So that is such a good like. Bit of time, like a piece of time in there that really
it always comes back full circle, right?
Just like fashion. But then on that front, like as those evolve, like I'm sure you have a bunch of collection of different gadgets, tools, technologies, all the kind of fun stuff. Sorry, you mentioned the Commodore 64. Would you consider, I guess, that like the first time you had access to like a computer or like something that is a smarter device? Like
yeah, pretty much. I think it was back then, and then you know that was also when fancy calculators were starting to get legs. Right, so I think that was the first time that I had to interact with devices, computers, and things that had brains.
Yeah, the calculators, like the ones that could draw like a graph, like a calculus, like derivative thing on there. Yeah. We took those for granted. It's like, that was so funny, and at least I'll speak from my experience from math in high school. It was like, sure, get your parents to pay like, what, $120 back then to get
then,
one of those,
yeah.
And then use it.
Expensive.
And then there's that one kid who will always manage to play Doom on it, or like just run like Pokemon on that. So, oh man, so many fun, relatable technology at the end. But in terms of tinkering on the Commodore 64, I feel like I always ask about this, that like my vivid memories with computers is obviously like you have the mouse. Even back then, a lot of it is like terminal at the same time. It's like it's very different from people's perspective. Do you remember what did you gear to your towards immediately in terms of, I don't think there were videos on there, I don't think there were like images, I don't think there were like text, like what was the stuff that screamed at you?
It reminds me of an Etch-a-Sketch.
Right.
It reminds me of Etch-a-Sketch, and I remember the how the click of the keyboard and how hard you had to press to get the keys down. Oh. Those are the two things I remember. I remember the screen was like an Etch-a-Sketch, and like actually pressing down on the console on the keyboard, it was very hard.
It's a feature nowadays. Yeah. People with the mechanical keyboards are like,
yeah, there's someone with one here. Yeah.
It's like, hey, I'm telling you, there's always an origin of something, origin of story on that. But I think it's so fun. But surely during that time as well, you did a bunch of education, a lot of school, and that's one of the things that a lot of people have different experiences throughout. One thing that I personally think about a lot is when I was in school, did I always think about going into tech? Was it like an obvious glaring thing where it's like, oh, that's the goal, that's the end game? So for you, in terms of like, was it always obvious that you wanted to go into tech during that time of your life?
So no. So I went to Boston College and I went on an athletic scholarship to play softball there. So I was really fortunate to be able to do that. And the when I got there, we weren't really supposed to because we were scholarship athletes, we weren't really supposed to have jobs, but I always had one and I wanted one. So naturally, where did I get a job? I got a job at the computer lab.
Oh, right.
Okay. So, you know, it would open at 6 a.m. I would work from 6 to 9 and I would, you know, whoever were the early birds that were up in the computer lab, I would either help them or just, you know, which would be fun, or just swipe their badge in, right? So it was always like a part of my life, even at college, but I only declared my major after taking a robotics class. I really liked the instructor. I took the robotics class. I really enjoyed it. And those were the, you know, that was Java and C++. And that's when I declared my major. So that was late sophomore year. So I declared quite late. And then my junior year had an internship at IBM, and everything kind of took off from there. And I was really, I knew that that was going to be my career.
Yeah, it's fun how you, everything you've mentioned is like it's piecing it together, right? It's like it's not a big sign with like Las Vegas lights that says like, oh, that is what you're doing, and it's so relatable because everybody has this similarity where it's like somehow you just keep on following these different passions and these different fun things to do. Working at a computer lab, I never had the opportunity, but I'm sure you had a bunch of stories. Or maybe do you remember anything crazy that happened in there, or anything that was just like memorable
that stood out? That was, you know, there were a lot of kids would stumble in after being out all night to get their paper done before they wanted to take a nap at noon. No, so there's a lot of those stories. I also remember the first day that the Macs were delivered that were now in different colors. Mm. So I remember how that like lit up the lab.
Literally.
Yeah, and I also remember that when I first started working, it was very small. Probably 2 years in, maybe my end of my sophomore year, early junior year, they completely took over a whole floor.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And then there was, you know, the lab was massive, and then there started to be like little mini R&D labs in the corner, and it turned out it almost into like a hangout instead of a place to do work.
That is always fascinating. I'm just going to go on a random tangent. I have a friend who, before coming to the States, he was building computer labs for like different education system, like in his home country. And it was kind of a similar story where it's like somebody has to like build these labs, and the next thing you know, it's like it just grows bigger and bigger. Like it's easy to take it for granted. It's easy to walk into all these fab like facilities that have like crazy stuff. But even back then, I think about it, it's always, always fun. And just so that I'm not being dumb over here, your major ended up being computer science.
Computer science, yeah.
That's so fun because, I mean, speaking of experience, I did do comp sci as well. But the thing is, like, it's different. Not only different schools. I didn't go to BI, I went to McGill at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. But just different time of people taking it. So, I mean, nowadays it's extremely popular. Like, every second person is in it. And don't get me wrong, it's great. It pushes the society, the world to go forward. But I think from your perspective of computer science back then, it was definitely not popular, was it?
No, especially candidly not for women. And the program then, it was, you know, pretty emerging. They were getting a lot of grants to invest, you know, in the program. The building that the classes were held in, you know, even when I was there, it moved from the Arts and Sciences building into the Business School building. So that even shows the progression of how the curriculum was developing. And I think, you know, that wasn't where you saw the full classes, right? I mean, my largest class, once I declared my major, was, you know, maybe 20 people at Boston College.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And that's, like, not, you know, that's unheard of, especially now.
Exactly. For this field at the end of the day, 20 people, man. I thought, well, to be fair, that we were about that many or less showing up to class, but I'm sure there were more people registered to it just because, of course, the technology of recording. And I'm sure it wasn't available back then, recorded classes or anything like that.
And I think there was only 3 women in the class, too.
Oh, wow, yeah.
So that was very different. It was very different. It was still exciting. You know, the professors were fantastic. I still keep in touch with one of them today, but it was different, yeah.
It's something that marks you at the end of the day, right? Just like these good influence during that time, and even the word pioneering. I think a lot of people just go through a lot of those, I guess, like systems, and then just kind of make something out of it. So I'm glad to hear it from that. You were mentioning a couple of classes. This is always a moment where I just think back and be like, oh yeah, those database classes, those like algorithm classes, system design classes. And I had one with like graphic vision or something like that, where you do a lot of like linear within a framework and everything. So was that pretty straightforward in terms of computer science classes back then? Or was there like a major difference that you could call out?
No, I think it was pretty similar. You know, you said the word algorithms, and like I had a chill down my spine because I took algorithms my second semester of senior year when most people are just finishing up, you know, their core classes, not their major classes. That was a difficult difficult time for me. But no, I think the curriculum, you know, and the types of classes were very similar. You just had less lab work, where I think now there's more actual hands-on lab work, and you get, you know, your projects are different as well, right? They were more individual projects, where now I think they're more lean towards even team building and doing things together, right? The coding is just, it's a different type of curriculum now.
No, that actually makes a lot of sense, because even one thing I can relate is when I did my undergrad, there was such a kind of blind part to the web world. So for example, like you would take your courses that was just listing the algorithms and everything, but there was so little exposure to like web, you wouldn't really any do like web languages, you wouldn't do any of that. So I feel like that's something I could call out from like the evolution of like the courses. Nowadays, I'm sure it's kind of mandatory to do a bit of web stuff on that.
So. Yeah, it was. That's actually a good point. You know, that was my second job. So I did the computer lab first, and then I managed the Boston College website my junior and senior
year. No way.
Yeah.
Do you remember any technologies on there? This is me geeking out in terms of like, we take React for granted, we take Angular for granted, but how was it back then? Was it just pure like HTML and...
It was very very HTML focused, boring, you know, nothing exciting. Everything had to, I remember going to the office that they set aside for me, and I would just sit there in the dark room. And now I think about the tools today and the languages, and it's just so different.
I'm telling you, but it's so good that you could tell the story, or you could like even just like mention those. Mm-hmm. Where even some people, just a step after that, you have like the jQuery, which people always give it crap. They give jQuery so much crap. I kind of get it, it's fine. They give PHP a lot of crap, but then like when you think about very just simple, vanilla
HTML.
Don't
forget where you came from.
I know. And the best part is, I don't even have any screenshots of that. I think that's what somebody would want to see, is like screenshots of the B website from back then, of what you were able to play around and touch with it.
Nope.
If not, we're going to call somebody out. Anybody who's listening that might have a screenshot, yes. That'd be the perfect gift to anybody out there. But one thing that we already dabbled a little bit into in terms of like coding languages and all that kind of stuff, like of course the university, right? Java, C++, like HTML and all that. Was that something that you already knew about before going into the program, or growing up you've already heard that, I guess, like existence of a programming language, or even like the older school, Fortran, OCaml, like?
Yeah, so growing up, just because of my father and you know the relationship we had with the gentleman I mentioned, the mayor, you know, I knew of it. You know, I learned the majority of you know, my background came from college, but you know, I didn't go in completely cold, which I think kind of helped me once I was ready to declare my major, right? Because then I knew, you know, a lot about the foundations at that time, and I think that was the most important part to make me even determine the career path I wanted to take, right? Even then, when I was in college.
I think that's the part that's very, I guess, relatable to people, because it's not an uncommon story where people would hear about languages, like, here and there as you grew up. Like, for me, I remember the first time HTML probably came in when I was like 14, 15 at school, someone mentioned it. There was like one class that did that. And then you don't hear about it for a couple of years. It will just be like a void of like, what's that? And then it comes back and it's like, oh wait, you can do so much with it at the end of the day. So I think that was a part I'm really usually excited about. On record, favorite programming language of all time, including back then, today, whenever.
Oh my gosh, you have to go back to the original Java. Come on.
I respect that. It's been there for a while for a lot of good reasons at the end of the day. So, okay, fine. That is a great thing at the end. And in terms of side projects, people keep on saying this because at school, one example I would have is, sure, you have your curriculum. Sometimes part of course you'll build a project and it'll be graded and all that kind of stuff. But was there anything that you caught yourself into, like a rabbit hole, and be like, wait, I wanna do this like for fun at the end of the day?
You know, after my robotics class, I was there that summer as well, not just during the semesters. And we took those robots, and we actually started a soccer tournament with the robots.
Okay, sure. So very casually.
We did that the summer of my... Was that sophomore year? I think it was sophomore year. Yeah, and we had some fun. We met once a week, you know, just kind of geeked out, played a little bit, built our own nets, and it was fun.
Oh my goodness, yeah. I mean, that's
Lego, all... Legos and C++. What else could you want?
Yeah, that could dominate the world at this point. I don't think anything stopping that, so. Oh man. I think that might be the origin of, like, Robot Wars, if anything. But on the other front, though, in terms of even when you already had a bit of exposure in terms of like just working in tech more professionally, when you're talking about like working with these websites and working with these, even at the robotics lab and everything, there's a point where I guess like somebody commits fully in terms of like now that you graduate, now that you're in the real world and everything. Do you remember the first time you were fully committed, fully full-time, working on tech, getting paid to do tech at the end of the day?
Yeah, so outside of those jobs that I had in college, it was kind of an interesting experience. So I tore my rotator cuff my junior year playing softball. So I couldn't go on the summer training trip because I was injured and I had to go to physical therapy. So because of that, I started applying to internships. And I got an internship at IBM very randomly, like, you know, went to a job fair, talked with someone, and, you know, somehow ended up in New York City with my arm in a sling having an interview. And got the internship. And I literally went to, you know, the office in New York City. It was at 590 Madison. I literally went there the first day. And I remember walking into that atrium, getting my badge and thinking, this is what I want to do, right? And then I went upstairs and we started the orientation, and I watched how IBM taught the way they wanted not only their technology innovated and managed, but also what it meant to IBM as an organization. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time I think it clicked in my head where I said, wow, you know, this is, it's so much bigger than what you're learning in school. Right. And I think, you know, that's when I really said, I left that day with those two experiences, being in the lobby and then hearing the instructor map the responsibilities to the actual business need.
Right.
It just clicked. And I just loved it.
Yeah. Everybody says internships are valuable, but when you're able to pinpoint where it's like, this is the part that really clicks and makes sense, like it's a different level of understanding.
Yeah. Right? And I think it clicked for me late, candidly. I think, you know, a lot of my friends in school, you know, sophomore, junior year, like they knew what they wanted to do. And I was like, you know, and I enjoyed my coursework and enjoyed college as an experience. But that day, that's when it clicked for me.
Well, me and you, to be fair, like, I feel like I wish definitely there would be more clarity earlier. But at the same time, I think it's something that just brings you where you are today at the end of the day. If you haven't gone through that, you would have never really like figured out, oh, this is what you like at the end of the day. Not saying that people, given the trajectory of being a dentist, is not great, but it's also like a very different part to how we compare a lot of that. So, but even IBM back then, of course, it's a household name. Everybody knows. Well, I don't know nowadays, but it's always a fun thing about that. But in terms of like, do you remember any fun task that you did during that time that internship there?
So my first my first project there, I was assigned to a group that was essentially trying to build what is Zoom today.
Okay, right.
Back in 2001. And I worked, he was based out of Newport, California. Yeah, Newport, California. And he had developers all over the country. So that was also my first experience with remote work. Mm-hmm. And back then you were on a conference call, right? And It was his name was Randy Langle. I will never forget him. He was one of the best mentors I ever had. And I remember him saying, we have a problem. IBM has given us dollars to spend to figure out this problem. I want to be able to see you on the other end when we're having this conversation. And that was not only an experience to see and understand, you know, how you know, people's minds work when they set their mind to get something done at a big corporation. But it was also a way for me to see how, you know, product plans were developed, how mm-hmm. you communicate with stakeholders, right? All this stuff you learn in school, but it really doesn't resonate until you experience it.
Yeah.
So I will never forget what he said and working on that as a first project.
He did say the word "see you." Like I literally want to see. It sounds so simple at the end of it, right? Yeah. And then once even my brain is already starting to take to be like, "Where's the camera? How do you plug that into it?" And then like, how do you send a lot of that through the waves of the internet and everything?
I remember his accent and everything, and that was such a, you know, you have moments that you just never forget, and that was one of them.
Of course, and even the word "mentor" you threw out there is that like you need them, not just you. Mm-hmm. Like you, anybody needs them at the end of the day, and I'm glad that there are these figures that exist in the world and everything. Yeah. So. Mm-hmm. Did you end up staying there full time at the end after the internship at IBM or?
Yeah, so again, I was very lucky. So I had the internship and then they asked me to stay on and do a few hours a week through the whole next year. So I was working like 3-4 hours a week doing like research and, you know, analyst type work from my dorm room in my free time. And then I did get the offer to work for them full time right before my senior year started. Mm. So that kind of helped a bit, right? Because I had a little bit of a more relaxed senior year than some others. That was also the year where a lot of companies, especially being billed on tech companies at that time, rescinded a lot of college graduate offers just because of the market at that time. And I was really lucky because I got to continue. So I graduated in, what was it, May, traveled a little bit in June, and started in July.
I mean, looking back, they made the right call anyways. I think looking back, I think it was a marking moment, as we keep on saying, where it's like just a reassurance, right? Like you're going in there with full confidence, and then you're able to do what you're excited to do at the end. Was it a combination of coding, or when you're mentioning analysts, how did that include in that whole mix of like able to use your comp sci skills into your day-to-day after?
Yeah, so that was really where I learned more product management and research. So I was doing a lot of market research at that time. I was filling in a lot of blanks on some roadmaps, and I was actually writing briefings for the investors of this product.
Yeah, and that's why I keep on saying it's exciting, because there's a Cinderella story. Comp sci, best engineer on the planet, you keep on pushing it, and you end up being a fellow somewhere. That's like obviously a Cinderella story. But then like the world of tech is massive. You get so many different paths, like everybody talks about this. So I think in the sense of, you know how there's, in the vein of like a software engineer choosing their path, right? They could be like an individual contributor, and then you could also be like more on the project management and like engineering management style and everything. For you, like what did your path look like? And I guess how did you make decisions along the way?
Yeah. It was, the decisions along the way, I think, were a combination of accidents and advice.
Happy accidents, as they call it.
Happy accidents. You know, when I started full-time at IBM, my first customer with IBM was Colgate-Palmolive. Mm-hmm. And I was doing their, website design and, you know, a few other small projects that they had contracted IBM out to do. And about 2 years into that project, you know, I had, or that customer engagement, I had always had a lot of opportunity to take additional learning and classes, and, you know, I had a mentor at IBM. And at the end of that 2 years, the business manager for Colgate-Palmolive was going out on maternity leave. Mm-hmm. And she said, hey, do you want to try, you know, and get into the management seat of the business here and basically manage the relationship between Colgate-Palmolive and IBM, and then by default essentially have all of the engineers dotted line into you while I'm out? My first reaction was, unfortunately, I'm not ready for that. And she said, stop, you know, give it a try, right? And I did, and I think, you know, during that period of time, you know, it was 4-ish months, I got a new taste of teamwork, right? Because I had it in college, right, with athletics. And then being able to step into that business manager role, I got to see how solving problems and bringing someone together was really what I was passionate about, just in the technology space. And then when she came back, I continued down the IC path for a few years, but eventually came back into management. And that's when I got into, you know, being a manager, got into sales a little bit, got into operations, and then went back into, you know, essentially product management. Had a team of engineers where I could, you know, essentially manage a new product and product development, things like that. And no, it wasn't maintenance at that point in time. It was all innovative and developing new for banking and retail customers after I transitioned out of Colgate. And I never forgot that initial experience of being able to lead the teams. And there goes the career path.
I keep on, there's a couple words in my head whenever you, that's a great story, no matter what. In terms of, number one, it's more like amplifying others, or just amplifying, right? A lot of it is that, like, there's so much you can do as single individuals, but then when your awareness kicks in, it's like, oh, you could amplify so much anything surrounding you. That's probably something that I definitely love hearing. And the other part is just a little push. I think that's like, if you think about it, if you look back, obviously, looking back, it's always 2020, but that little push seems so necessary, but it needs so much from the other individual to also push you at the end of the day. So mm-hmm. I think those are the parts that, as you were saying, like, oh yeah, then the rest is like history at that point. It's like yeah. you got these little moments over there that mm-hmm. Really puts it all together. So I really do enjoy that. And then when a lot of people think about this, where the IC and the EMs and all the, I guess, like these words in technology at the end of the day, there's a point where we think about, hey, when do I give up on coding? Because you can't do all of it if you're going to be having so much responsibility. Even for me to think about, what am I doing nowadays? Like, of course, everybody has it in them to be like, I always want to be coding. But then there's also other responsibilities that you also find very fun. How does the project get delivered? How many engineers do you need? How long is it going to take? Like, what's the hurdle? Where's the BRD? Where's the PRDs on all that? So I guess from your experience in terms of, was there a defining moment where you were like, I just can't code anymore or not? I feel like this is a really personal question, like in terms of how we think about this.
Yeah, for me, it was probably about the year that I left IBM. And I just can't be ingrained in coding anymore. Because I really do believe, like, the most successful managers and leaders, they understand the foundation and they never lose touch. I think it's really important to never lose touch. But I think for me, that was when I really decided that I was going to go down, you know, more of the management track, and leaving, you know, my degree and my work at IBM behind and doing less coding. It was like almost like a crisis of conscience initially, right? Because you invested so much time and energy and even, you know, with the education in one space. And I think that's why that's another reason why I think it's always important to make sure you don't lose or forget where you came from, that I like to say, right? But that was when it changed for me, when I left IBM and I went to that startup. And, you know, it just really opened my eyes to the different ways to elevate other people in a way that helped companies. And I just, like I said before, like, never look back.
No, of course. I mean, it's always in you. It's always there. Coding is always going to be there. There's not a chance you'll skip out in terms of being able to play around with it. So one thing I definitely do want to spend time talking about in terms of CTO, the word CTO. I think people have different journeys on becoming CTO. I mean, like, this is just me speculating a lot of that. But it's something that is so valuable to know and have and, you know, just taking inspiration from. So maybe just in a very, very general high level, what is a CTO? What does it even stand for? I feel like we throw this word a lot nowadays.
Yeah, so I think, the chief technology officer role, right, it really is, it needs to be a very thoughtful mix between communicating direction to the business and also being able to have, you know, the respect of the folks that are on your team, right? And no matter where you are, kind of like you said, you know, there's such a different definition of mm-hmm. the role, essentially based on where the company is, right? I think, you know, when you think about the types of CTOs that are able to spend, you know, 80% of their time, you know, helping innovate versus, you know, CTOs that are almost forced to help the business, you know, right size and get into a place where the operations are stable before you innovate again. It just varies. And I think, you know, the most important part of, you know, the position that I'm in today is really being that connection or that bridge mm-hmm. between the business and tech, so that the tech is appreciated in a way that continues to kind of survive the life of the business, but also in a way that gives the, you know, tech resources and employees and our partners a stage. So it's such a balance, especially where I am right now, but there's so many different types of CTOs to your point. But I think that the role itself is always responsible for being that bridge.
I really like how you articulated that, mostly in the sense of, like, the one way I look at this is kind of crazy, is that, you know, there's a funnel, but then there's a reverse funnel, where if you pick, like, mobile software engineers, you pick them from any company, fairly similar technology, and it's kind of like a template that kind of works at the end of the day. But then once you go a little bit further ahead, where it's like the staff engineers and then like the principal engineers, like it's slowly get a little bit bigger in terms of like what the responsibilities are, right? Yep. Some of them will be touching architecture, but some of them are just like super doing a lot of research to make sure that this is very, very optimal at the end of the day. And then you could apply the same thing with like managers and then vice presidents and everything of that, is that as you go through those levels, it just gets wider and wider, this like reverse funnel that I think about in terms of responsibility
as
it goes.
That's a great way to explain it.
So every time you mention any responsibilities or anything that a CTO is valuable for, and of course they're definitely valuable for all that, that makes a lot of sense that one CTO somewhere would be looking at something different than a CTO somewhere else at the end of the day. So but one thing that I guess, like, we're all humans at the end of the day, like, what are some, like, day-to-day, like, tasks that you got to do? Because, I mean, like, for example, I got to eat breakfast every day. I know some people don't. Okay, that's a bad example. But in terms of things, is it mostly, like, day-to-day meetings? Or is there, like, some specific ritual that you like being in?
Yeah, so I love a good routine. you know, day-to-day, when I come in the morning, so I'm up fairly early. You know, I get in the morning and... you know, I check in essentially with, you know, the leadership team in one way or another, whether it's folks that are sitting here, whether it's through a Slack channel, you know, whatever it is. I have a, you know, I check in with someone just to get a pulse on the business. I have a set of reports that I look at that show me, you know, everything from performance to, you know, operational statistics. And I just kind of like settle into the day, you know, over the past, you know, 8 hours, 6 hours, whatever it might be in that particular day since I left. So there's like this grounding of the day that I find very helpful that I never used to do. And it might sound simple, but I used to like run right into meetings at 8 or whatever time, right? Or 6 a.m. in internationally, right? And that really wasn't grounding me as a leader into the business. It was just getting me into the day-to-day, right? So now we have that ritual in the morning. Then, you know, what I really like to spend the time doing is communicating with the different functions and making sure that, you know, the perception of technology is essentially as good as we all want it to be, right? Because here and now, that's very important. And then the individual meetings with the team members get me really ingrained in the day-to-day. So I basically start high and then I dive in, and by the end of the day, I'm back out again dealing with whatever the day is.
Yeah, I like hearing this because it's so relatable. When you're talking about the grounding thing, where it's like even a dashboard, don't get me wrong, like it's really hard to get a good dashboard. Like for any team of knowing the pulse of anything, number one, it's really hard. So that is something that I'm sure it could be its own episode of like, what is your daily dashboard? But it also sounds really familiar where I know a lot of people have like kind of just a morning to-do list or like just a thing where it just like tells you this is what we're tackling today. And like a lot of those processes, I keep on saying it's relatable just because it works. And just hearing you and your experience, how it helps you do your day-to-day stuff, is very encouraging to know that there's more reasoning as to why people do it. My to-do list is a .md file on GitHub that I just version control every day to make sure that there's stuff today, and then that's basically how that goes.
And when do you do it? Do you check it out every morning, every night? Like, how does that work?
Once in the morning, once in the evening.
There
so there's usually two commits a day. One in the morning, that does it. And it's fun because once in a while, like, you have the Git history. So, like, you just pull a random commit from, like, 4 years ago and be like, what was I doing at that time? Nobody wants to know or see that. But also, I think maybe I skipped this part in the sense of like, how does one become a CTO, I guess? I'll just throw random words examples as well, that CTO founders, you have an idea in college out of nowhere. You just be like, sure, I'll be the CTO of this and do that. So I think there's a million examples, but I guess from your take, what is a, I guess, general path to becoming a CTO at the end of the day?
Yeah, you know, I think that just to your founder's comment, I think there's such a different and important difference in the mentality, right? Like, do you want to be that initial creator, or do you want to be, you know, the person that inherits and either fosters or changes, right? And I think, you know, based on my background, right, it was almost, in this particular case, it was almost... you know, planned out to the minute of being able to inherit, right? Because, you know, I had the luxury and the good fortune through my mentors and all the companies that I work for to have the software and the infrastructure and the hardware background, right? So, you know, my path, you know, through those companies to the CTO role was simply based on everything that I've learned, the people I've worked with, and then the folks that gave me opportunity. Mm-hmm. That's one of the reasons why I'm so focused on and want to make sure that there's enough mentors out there and that everyone's helping someone else, you know, in their career. Because every time I was able to take a step, it was because someone believed in me more than I believed in myself and wanted me to take the opportunity. And I think my entire career of getting to higher levels in the company was just based off of, you know, reliability, good performance, and the ability to manage a team. And it's that simple. As long as you have the background, which I was able to get in all those areas through my career, and it was a circumstance of opportunity and hard work. I'm really proud of that, actually.
I'm more than proud, because the way I would put this is making the best out of everything. You said it maybe a couple seconds ago, in the sense of like trusting somebody to make the best out of something. It's hard, right? You can't take it for granted. But when you're talking about, like, you don't do this alone. You need the knowledge around you. You need mm-hmm. the people around you, and you need to be able to connect all of that. Mm-hmm. And that's when you're talking about this position of, like, seeing what's around and gelling it together. Or maybe it's already gelled together, but just, like, make it better. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's one way of kind of just guiding people in terms of, like, if you do have those interests, those skills of doing that, that's one path of getting to becoming CTO in that journey at the end of the day. So I think it's so valuable that you share these kind of, like, I guess very simple to understand, like, events. Because a lot of people be like, oh, it's because somebody, like, had to do, like, 6 years of research into here, and then they managed to, like, plug it into that, and then, like, but no, it's just know what you like and just keep on making everybody around you better, and that kind of just leads you to that journey at the end. But then this is a random tangent that I hear once in a while, is I have seen companies that outsource their CTOs in terms of having contract CTOs. And what's the difference between that and a consultant? I'm not fully even sure to begin with, but maybe your take on this, whether it's something that you've seen personally, but what exactly is a, I guess, contract worker CTO?
Yeah, so you know, the short answer to the question of, you know, the difference between a contractor or a CW and a contract CTO, when you simply allow for that title in the position, it usually brings more senior and more experienced talent for you to hire. So just naming it differently is I think a help, but in reality it's almost the same thing, right? You're brought on for a finite period of time, usually to solve one problem, and then it's time for you to move on. It's usually, you know, a significant dollar amount to solve some very difficult problem maybe not many people want to take on, and then you usually have the opportunity to apply for or interview for the permanent CTO. It's a balance, you know, because it's really hard to get employee buy-in, in my experience, when you're using the word interim. And a lot of times, you know, you need to rally the team members to get whatever that interim CTO was brought in to do, get it done, and it's just a different. A little bit of a different mindset, it's a bit of a different culture. You know, I would always err on the side of a full-time, you know, but I think there's always a need for someone that's available from a consulting firm to swoop in tomorrow instead of going through a one-month interview process. So it has its pros and cons. I'm personally supportive of all these different types of roles, but I think it benefits the company more to have full-time.
Yeah, and this is why I love these opportunities to talk about this conversation in terms of, like, not only just the startup world, but the startup world is very flexible, right? Like, people have been starting companies even without a main, like, engineer at the end of the day, right? The people are finding very resourceful, and I have had these conversations where people are like, we don't really have that much tech going on. Should we just have, like, a contract worker, CTO come in and do that kind of stuff? So I feel like this is just hearing it from you, but just anybody who's out there that are thinking about what are the different options. Maybe people didn't even know it existed that could, like, have like an outsourced CTO. So I'm just glad that we had your take on that one. So one thing that I think about a lot in my day-to-day is tools and software that I use daily. I think that's something that, like, I cannot say it's stuff that people just take it for granted. Not everybody takes it for granted, but, like, there's stuff on my Google Calendar that just works and it's just there. So I guess, like, just random tidbits of fun, I guess, items on your list of tools and software that you use daily.
You know what I still use every day? Evernote.
Okay, fair, yeah.
Right? Yeah, but that's really where I'm at right now. I'm at managing the day-to-day of my activities and you know, the requirements of this job. There, you know, you'll find me now quite a bit, obviously, on ChatGPT.
Okay, right.
but yeah, I'm not. You're not going to get an exciting answer from me out of the tools I use. I'm pretty basic.
No, I think what you said is more than exciting at the end of the day. Like, Evernote, why don't you use the Notes app? We'll figure that part out because there's always the differences on that. And even ChatGPT, that's another one that people love diving into in the sense of, like, there's always the reluctancy of using a new tool. The only reason why I talk about these tools is that, like, the good ones disrupt, right? Mm-hmm. The good ones changes your flow to adapt to the tool. I mean, they're not going to market it that way. They'll we just adapt to you. But ChatGPT mentioned that in the sense of, like, the reliability. I know a bunch of engineers that use it day to day instead of Stack Overflow, instead of Google nowadays, like ChatGPT. So you got any advices for people, like, starting to dabble into it if they haven't used that as a technology at the end?
You know,
not to use it.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's such an interesting conversation with, you know, our legal and our privacy teams, right? And I think that it's, you know, it's really important for anyone using it within any company, right, to really refer to the company's stance before diving in. But I think, you know, I think in general, you know, it's those types of advancements are so, they're such a wonderful way to speed up a process where someone might have you know, not developed the skill as much as others, you know. And as an example, you know, it shouldn't be used right now, in my opinion, right, to replace. Mm-hmm. And, you know, using that to, you know, help someone get started on a thought, right, you know, take something to the next level and then be able to massage it as your own, I think that's such a benefit that, you know, we should all, you know, consider using. If you want to pass something off as your work, you know, I definitely don't condone that. But I think, you know, putting your voice around, you know, some of the information that it would return is so important.
Yeah, and it's all about the, I keep on saying, like, that was an educated answer. In the sense of, like, there are a lot of factors to determine why you could either agree or disagree with technology. I get shticked sometimes for, what is it, GitHub Copilot, where it's like, I keep on saying that you should use it probably after 3 years of professional software engineering. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, Not that you shouldn't use it immediately out of the box, but you should take it with a grain of salt. Everything on there. So that's kind of how I see it. But then there's a point where it's going to get so good that you could literally just use it out of the box. So that's why it's living the transition period. And I know for myself, there's always new tools, reluctancy, non-reluctancy. And I'm glad that it's a topic that people get to mention over there. But kind of in the same tangent on that flow, in terms of, like, sure, these technologies kind of come into play, and obviously some of them cost, some of them don't cost, and everything. There's a lot of, like, investment that we talk about as an organization, but even as, like, a single human. So I guess, like, for a company out there, like, what are valuable tech investments for an organization in terms of, like, how do you know it's worth spending time doing this?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's something that, you know, more companies are starting to be more thoughtful about in general. You know, the current market conditions don't really allow for, you know, massive capital expenditure R&D budgets now, right? And I think, you know, for leaders in any space, especially technology, it's important to make sure that, you know, your underlying goals map to what the company is trying to do in a particular year. You know, I'd be very surprised if a board of directors or a CEO would say no to some sort of technology investment that would help meet the company's financial goals. And I think, you know, that's a skill, but it's so much of an art to be able to say, this is what we need to do as a business. Now let's bring the technology along to help us, you know, increase that efficiency and just essentially get things done faster. So I think, you know, the advice in general is just to make sure that these functions, especially technology, right, like we're talking about, never loses touch with the business, because the money will flow and the investments will come as long as you're doing the right thing for the business. Now, if you're in a startup, right, and you have that founder CTO mindset, you make those decisions. But if you're not, you have to make sure you're aligned. Otherwise, you're going to end up spending money that's, you know, not good for anyone.
Yeah, and everybody wished that they have the money to spend on every single new technology out there. Mm-hmm. So that is another fun topic. But yeah, this is more like a wrap-up thought more than anything, is what are some, I guess, guiding lights, or what are some models that you look up to as you become the best gen, if we put it that way? What advices do you have for yourself, and what advices do you have for people in general?
Wow, that's a good one. I think my advice, you know, for people in general is to just remember that whatever they learn, they should pass on to someone else. And I don't mean to belabor that point, and I know it sounds quite simple, but, you know, in the day of, you know, everybody trying to get ahead, we have to remind everyone that you can't get ahead unless you bring everybody else with you, right? And I think that that's a simple but really important statement. I still talk to so many of my mentors. So, you know, they're really my guiding light. And, you know, I'm a big proponent of quotes and, you know, like, you know, motivational things, and no matter what time of day it is, actually. And, you know, one quote that I always remember is, courage is catching. And, you know, I think that's really important, because as you grow in different roles and you become more of a leader or a, you know, a role model of others, it's important to make sure that no one forgets where they came from, and that in the event of the need to make a difficult decision, they have support, right? And I think, you know, showing courage in anything that you're doing is more important than literally anything else in your career.
I don't think anybody could have said it better. I think if people are looking for quotes, there has been plenty, plenty, plenty throughout this whole discussion. So I just want to say, actually, is there anywhere that people could follow you on? Are you on LinkedIn? What's kind of the situation over there?
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely on LinkedIn. That's probably the best place right now, as we're getting kicked out of this room. And when something else comes up that I'm working on, I'll send it over your way.
That is amazing. We're always looking forward to anything that you're doing. But once again, Jen, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you. This was great. Great to see you.
Awesome. And then I'll catch you guys on the next one.
Once again, big thank you to Jen for sharing so many amazing stories. If you would like to be on the show, send an email to contact@parrot2.com. For new episodes, definitely follow the show on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or any of your favorite streaming platform. And check out the merch at parrot2.com/shop. Thank you again for listening. Big love. I'll catch you on the next one.